Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We hope this will be a much quieter week, but still with insightful commentary on the major issues of the week. Jim, we start off with what is, I think, best described as a tentative good martini, but good nonetheless based on what we've seen so far. As many people know, back at the beginning of March, all these different sequester cuts were announced. Not all of them kicked in right away. In fact, most of them didn't kick in right away. And the FAA was told to trim $600 million from its budget. And so air traffic controllers are being reduced. We're also going to be seeing TSA workers reduced in numbers. So the flying public is being told to expect chaos and anarchy in America's airports and essentially to buckle down for massive delays. Those fears are posted all over the Drudge Report and some other places here on Monday. But if you look at the little FAA map and the status of airports across the country, there's a ton of green lights all over the place, with the exception of LaGuardia and Kennedy up in New York. And LaGuardia is always a mess, so I'm not really sure how much of that is a result of the changes from the FAA. So while we may see some impacts as time goes on here, so far there doesn't seem to be much of an impact whatsoever.
Yeah, worth noting, Greg, this is looking at the general airport. It doesn't mean every single flight is taking off on time. I did this at 9:40, posted this over on the campaign spot, and it was, you know, once again, the flight was mostly green. Now we can update some good news. Teterboro back on schedule, JFK back on schedule. Newark is having is up to the red category, which means delays more than 45 minutes. Also, Charlotte's getting past is in that 15 to 45 minute point. But most of the country is green. Which, you know, it's a Monday morning. You figure it's a fairly busy travel day. This is not the catastrophic response that we've been warned about. And lo and behold, there's another case of people saying, oh, my goodness, the sequester is going to be the end of the world. And once again, Chicken Little is incorrect. Now, like many folks, I'm a little bit wary or suspicious that, you know, the government is cutting where it should, and the desire to employ the Washington Monument strategy of making your cuts in the most public and popular, you know, programs in order to stir up general opposition and public outrage over the cuts in order to get the money restored. But really, so far, I mean, this is not all that different from what we were told, you know, March 1st. We are now actually probably, what, 7 or 8 weeks into the dread national nightmare that is sequester, right, Greg?
Yeah.
Most Americans haven't even noticed, really. We've had other things on our mind in the past week in particular.
It's easy to be overshadowed, even if there had been a problem, by what's been happening. But that's clearly so far not really a problem, except in airports that traditionally have problems anyway. So we'll see as time goes on if all these horrific projections prove to be accurate. But on to martini number two now, and the next two martinis are related to the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombing and the dramatic manhunt over the last couple of days of last week. But now one of the issues popping up in this story is related to a major story that unfolded on Capitol Hill last week, and that's the gun debate. Enter Reuters with this story. Quote, in the confrontation with police on the streets of a Boston suburb, Tamerlan and Jokhar Tsarnaev were armed with handguns, at least one rifle and several explosive devices, authorities say. But neither brother appears to have been legally entitled to own or carry firearms where they lived, a fact that may add to the national debate over current gun laws. Tamerlan Tsarnaev, 26, who was killed in the shootout with police, would have been required to apply for a gun license with the local police department where he lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts, but there is no record of him having done so. Tsarnaev's younger brother, Jokhar, 19, who was captured alive on Friday after the manhunt, would have been too young to get a handgun license. Under state law, residents under 21 may only apply for a so-called firearms identification card, which allows the holder to own only rifles that hold 10 rounds or less and shotguns. So, Jim, the initial conservative reaction here is, wow, there's a big shocker. Criminals didn't follow the law to get their weapons, but you may very well see liberals once again trotting out this legislation, Harry Reid among them, to say that, wow, even the most strong gun control laws in the country in a state like Massachusetts might not be enough.
Yeah, and the reason I nominate this for the bad martini is we have a circumstance in which every bit of evidence, the more evidence that we see supporting our side of the argument, that, look, criminals are not interested in obeying the law. That's what makes them criminals. And that here you have a state that had some of the strictest gun control laws in the country. These guys still got their hands on, you know, pistols and rifles. And, oh, by the way, we're able to put together bombs. I mean, The point is that somebody who is evil, someone who has mayhem on their mind, will have ability to get these things. Short of, you know, absolute total door-to-door confiscation of all privately held firearms, which the gun control folks keep telling us they don't want to have happen. However, my fear, and I think you're going to see this being cited as an example of, oh, this is why we need more laws. Even though, pretty obviously, once you become a terrorist, you're not really interested in obeying laws. That's what makes you a terrorist. Yeah. One of the reasons the gun issue is so frustrating is that there's really no piece of evidence that can shake the gun control folks from realizing, oh, you know what? Maybe this doesn't really work. Maybe the people who we are trying to stop are not deterred by passing one law or another and only deterred by good police work. This really is a faith-based initiative, Greg. And I think that the calling for gun control is going to be really fascinating to watch. I think it'll be interesting to see how many people in Watertown express interest in owning a firearm after an experience like this. In a sense of, look, while the cops in Boston and the cops in Watertown, the cops in that whole region, the FBI, they all did the absolute very best that they could. Not too hard to argue the sense that a lot of that area would feel very vulnerable and might feel like, look, heaven forbid someone really dangerous comes across my path. If I own a gun, I have a chance at being able to survive a confrontation. If I'm unarmed, I have no chance of surviving a confrontation with these guys.
2 points that come to mind after that. Dianne Feinstein was on Fox News Sunday yesterday, and Chris Wallace asked her that exact question, and her thought was, well, you can do that with a shotgun, a la Joe Biden. And there were so many police around, I can't imagine that you wouldn't have been protected. And of course, you know, the palm immediately hits the forehead, like every situation is going to have that many officers in such a small, concentrated area. The only way I think this is bad for conservatives in the gun debate, if it's honestly wage gun debate, which of course it never is if they got these weapons through internet sales or the gun show.
A gun show, yeah. The other thing which would be really interesting is, you know, we're trying to figure out how they – obviously the bombs are homemade, et cetera. And there's some other folks who are, you know, speculating that, you know, when he was – one of the older brother was over in Russia, he might have gotten trained on this. A very interesting wrinkle to be all this will be if they somehow obtained their guns, like, overseas or had it smuggled into the country or something like that. But in other words, like, we have thought about our gun issue being a national issue, and the argument we always make, you know, the gun control folks is always, well, look, local gun restrictions don't work because there's always some other jurisdiction that has more lax gun laws. Well, we live in the world, you know? So even if the United States were to have the strictest gun laws in the whole wide world, chances are people would still be able to get guns by illegally smuggling them over our borders. Kind of like Eric Holder would know something about this, right? Moving guns across the border illegally, right?
No, so, he was completely out of the loop, remember?
That's right. That's right. It reached his office. It reached his secretary. It reached his chief of staff. But it never got to Eric Holder.
Right.
Now, unless you hold it up to his face and make his eyes look at the memo, he's never going to see that stuff. But anyway, like, the idea of international arms smuggling has really kind of been an element that has been missing from our gun debate. And so it would kind of observe that, you know, here you are harassing Mr. Legal Gun Owner, who's no threat to anybody. But here you have, you know, gangs and groups like these guys getting their guns from overseas. It kind of, you know, makes the argument, wait a minute, that, you know, eventually, Greg, this will turn into an argument for border security, won't it?
That would be nice. That'd be one nice aspect of this. But you mentioned the possibility that the weapons and certainly the radicalization occurred while the elder brother was overseas. And that sadly leads into our crazy martini, because as we learned late last week, the Russian government kind of put out a bulletin to our FBI and said, hey, keep an eye on this guy. He might be radical. And turns out they did investigate him. They interviewed him, Tamerlan. They interviewed his parents. They interviewed his neighbors and friends and that sort of thing. But apparently this happened just before he became more radicalized, made that trip overseas. And now we know why. We don't really know exactly where he went once he flew from the U.S. to Moscow several months ago. And that's because, Jim, his name was misspelled on the flight manifest, apparently. So we couldn't track him because of a typo.
That's really unnerving if Lindsey Graham's account is accurate. Basically, his statement is that, let's see, he went to Russia because the name was misspelled. They put him into Aeroflot. He was flying the Russian airline, and they put in the name differently than, or I guess, you know, think about it, you're dealing with, you know, different languages that have different letters in the alphabet and different, you know, translations and transliterations of names and stuff. Very unnerving. To think that the FBI would not be able to know that he went into Chechnya and Dagestan. We don't know precisely what the Russians told the FBI, but Jake Tapper had reported this weekend apparently this doesn't happen all the time. Apparently the Russians don't go to the FBI and say, every Chechen immigrant in your country we think is a potential terrorist. So apparently this is fairly extraordinary. Now, apparently the FBI talked to these guys, talked to their family. The crazy mother is saying that they were monitoring his internet and all that stuff. God only knows if that's the case. However, you look at this and thinking, they ought to have been monitoring their internet source, right? Clearly they weren't, because this guy was watching these radical imams and you know, had a YouTube playlist called Terrorism. Kind of unnerving to see how much the red flags that were there. And I know that the FBI folks are doing their very best, but you just kind of get the feeling, particularly as we contemplate this massive immigration reform, that there just might be too much work for this current system to do. You know, that in other words, if a guy like this could slip through the cracks, even when the Russians come and say, hey, we think this guy might be a radical Islamist and somebody we're worried about. And the other brother, 6 months after he becomes a U.S. citizen, he's setting bombs in the streets of Boston. Real reason to have some doubts about our current system. And I think a lot of us would say, look, short of this massive 840-page legislation designed to get, you know, look, if you're having trouble with the current system, how is this our current immigration law enforcement going to handle 11 million new cases? Very unnerving to think about all the just the influx and how many bad folks might slip through the cracks in a system like this. So there's more to learn on this, but seeing stuff like spelling errors causing the you know, government's data or information or intelligence that they have on this guy slipping through the cracks, very unnerving, and it kind of suggests why we should be perhaps a little wary before making any, you know, big sweeping changes with a system that is already kind of creaking and not meeting the fairly basic standard of keep terrorists out of the country.
The conventional wisdom right now is that the older brother was the radical, and he perhaps brought the younger brother along for the ride. The little brother is now squealing, if you can call it that, when he's just writing his answers, but hopefully he's scared enough to spill as much as we need to really put the pieces together here. I guess we'll find that out in due time, but it sounds like he's talking, so I guess that's a reason to be optimistic a little bit here. Jim, a much better start to the week than last week. Let's keep our fingers crossed and hope it stays that way.
Not the highest bar to clear, but yes, Greg. And hopefully the rest of the week will be calm.
Absolutely. He's Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.